Brooklyn wasn't always a borough known for art and culture, but today it's bursting with it. Hi, I'm George Bodarkey, and this is Cityscape on 90.7 FM and WFUV.org. Brooklynites are doing a wide range of interesting things in some pretty interesting places. Just ask Oriana Leckert. She writes about this kind of stuff on her blog called Brooklyn Spaces. Oriana also just published a book by the same name. But before we sit down with Oriana to talk about her work, let's step inside one of the hubs of culture and creativity featured in her book, the Coney Island Circus Sideshow. She goes by the name of Princess Pet, and her occupation is anything but typical. I asked her to list her primary responsibilities. She outlines them in this order: snake charmer, walk on broken glass, hang upside down with a straitjacket on.
What else? Laying down on bed of nails, fire, and so on.
Princess Pat is a performer in the Coney Island Circus Sideshow. In her bright orange wig, jean shorts, orange tights, and high heels, she's about to take the stage for a dance number with her partner, a 9-foot-long albino python named Dionysus.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome out to the stage the one and only Princess Pat!
Pat dances on stage, holding the snake above her head. She then lies down and kicks one leg up, extending the snake alongside it. The crowd loves it. Pat's no stranger to snakes. She grew up in Nigeria, but she's aware of the inherent dangers of working with the slithering creatures.
It could squeeze the hell out of me and kill me if I'm not careful, yeah. And sometimes it hisses, it goes...
Pat's been working with the sideshow since 1996. She stumbled on it during a visit to Coney Island to hear a Nigerian band. She went to sideshow school, learned the ropes, I mean the snakes, and as Pat puts it, she found her crowd. That was Princess Pat, a snake charmer at the Coney Island Circus Sideshow. You can find them online at coneyisland.com. The Coney Island Circus Sideshow is just one of the many fascinating places featured in writer Oriana Leckert's new book, Brooklyn Spaces, 50 Hubs of Culture and Creativity. I recently sat down with her on a park bench in East Williamsburg, Brooklyn. So, Oriana, how do you define a Brooklyn space?
That is the big question. It has been an evolving term, sort of since I started this project. At this point, what I'm really interested in is spaces that are kind of at the intersection of community and culture and creativity. So something where people have kind of like maybe a niche idea that is a little unusual and is, but they go for it so strongly and with such vigor that they almost attract to them other people who are looking to try to do that same thing. And it's, you know, obviously makes for more interesting research and reading if the space itself happens to also be, appropriated or like redone from like an old building into something new. And I feel like in a city like New York, which is so dense, it's hard for that not to be the case. I mean, other than your shiny new condos, everything has this sort of palimpsestic history. If you start digging, well, what was it 5 years ago and 10 years ago and 100 years ago? And, you know, the buildings that are old enough, if you can go back and trace that, I find that absolutely fascinating.
What was that first space when you paused and you said, you know what, there's something to this. I want to dig a little deeper.
Right. One of what I considered the first Brooklyn space was the Bushwick Trailer Park. So when I started this project in 2010, I happened to go to like three very different spaces in the same weekend, and it was the Bushwick Trailer Park, the House of Yes, and the 123 Community Center. And the 123 Community Center closed almost immediately thereafter. It was like an anarchist Skillshare, and they had like a bike repair shop in the basement and like a zine library, and they did like pancake breakfasts for like the neighborhood kids. The Bushwick Trailer Park was what it sounds like. It was a bunch of artists who had gotten Airstream trailers and like various trailers from Craigslist from all over the Northeast, and they had a huge warehouse in East Williamsburg, and they put all the trailers inside and called them art studios, and they would have big community dinners and, you know, music shows and things like that. And they also did not last very long. The media source that broke the story of the Bushwick Trailer Park was Gawker, and you could probably imagine Gawker was not particularly kind to the idea of a bunch of, you know, artists living in a trailer park in Bushwick. So they were very, anyway. And the other one was the House of Yes, which is an aerial training and performance center. And so that was sort of, I had been going out and doing things and being in Brooklyn, but seeing all those spaces right in a row, that was really the moment for me when I thought, there's something really incredible going on here. This just like unbelievable overflow of creativity. And it looks so different for so many people. And I felt like it really needed to be documented.
How do you go about discovering these places?
I am kind of part of, you know, I mean, at this point, now I'm sort of like a little bit known and kind of like the Brooklyn Underground. So people recommend spaces to me and, you know, but I'm probably, I started by reading like Nonsense NYC and the various like mailing lists that talk about events. And then, you know, once the name of a space would stick in my mind, if I saw it 3 or 4 times, I would think, okay, that's probably a place that I want to visit.
You mentioned the Bushwick Trailer Park and that it was underground. It was shut down after it was publicized. How many of these places are underground, shall we say? Sure. Not necessarily illegal, we won't say that.
Well, so in the book, I tried to be a little more, I wanted to show a broader variety because the book is, so I've been doing this project online for a bunch of years.
It started as a blog.
Yeah, it started as a blog because, well, it started in my head as a book proposal, and my agent said in 2010, she said, Brooklyn, I just don't know if there's going to be like mass appeal, which, you know, now is hilarious, but I think that she was speaking for, she was not thinking about like what is happening in Brooklyn, but like, will people in Kansas actually care about this book? And maybe in 2010 they wouldn't have. Hopefully in 2015, maybe they will. I hope that they will.
Brooklyn is pretty much on the map now.
Kind of become an international brand. So on the website, I felt like I really wanted to uncover like really the underground, like these people who are doing just like the craziest, most experimental, wild, bizarre things. But for the book, because I did want people in Kansas to care, and because I do think that there's art that exists outside of, you know, the sort of nether deep reaches of the underground, I included a lot more spaces like the Morbid Anatomy Museum, like the Waterfront Museum, like Gen Space, which is a community bio lab, like a citizen science type. They are the only citizen science biohacker group in the country that has been approved by the Centers for Disease Control. The Centers for Disease Control certified their lab as like meeting their safety standards, and so they're the only one in the country that has that relationship. So it's not, the book is not only about the underground. The book is definitely about wherever people are kind of coming together in a space that's really strange and doing something that's really, I think, creative and beautiful and exciting.
What is the most creative, the wackiest thing you've come across?
The wackiest thing I've come across? Well, I don't know how you define wacky. That's really hard.
How do you define wacky?
Yeah. I mean, one of also my early discoveries is a group called Rubilad, which is an art collective, and they've been throwing kind of underground art parties since the 90s. They were in Williamsburg. They were like one of the very first groups of whatever this moment, this movement is. They were kind of the early adopters. And they were, there was an art movement in Williamsburg in the 90s called Immersionism, and I think perhaps from my research it only existed in Williamsburg in the 90s, but it was about creating these spaces where everything was itself an installation and you were kind of part of the art while also interacting with the art and consuming the art. So there was a place, it was a group of immersionists, and they created this bar that was like, the theme was water, and they had actual waterfalls coming over the bar that you had to like stick your hand through to get a glass. The tables were like dappled. They had like blue sequiny fabric on them. There were like projections on the walls that made it the way that you see light through like an aquarium, that sort of dappling. So everything was kind of part of this. It was all of a piece. It was art to consume, to be, to experience. And so Rubilad was, I think, influenced by that culture. And they, through these parties, they still throw them, that are completely immersive, and their space in Bed-Stuy is probably one of the wackiest, I guess. They've been throwing parties at that. By the time that space closed, they had been throwing parties for 20-some years, and they had a policy of never throwing anything out. So the parties would be like deeply themed, where like, you know, they would do all of this decorating and like make art, and everyone had to wear costumes that all were around a theme. And then all that stuff, they just kind of stuck on the walls, stuck on the ceiling, and stuck on the chairs. And so the place is like just bristling with like decades worth of like creative insanity. So I guess I would call that pretty wacky.
What other spaces have particularly unique histories?
Yeah, a lot of them have very... I mean, I definitely looked for spaces that had unique histories. The House of Yes was an ice warehouse, like for storing ice. The Yankee Ferry and the Waterfront Museum are two of the oldest boats on the entire Eastern Seaboard. They're both in the book. The Body Actualized Center was a chicken slaughterhouse, and then it became a yoga studio and sort of a gathering space for kind of the modern hipster new age people with crystals and yoga and tantric sex workshops and that sort of thing.
How many places would you estimate that you've visited since you've started this project in 2010?
Well, I've written about probably 150 having been to in my life. I mean, I have like my secret master list, which has like 300 spaces on it, and then 100 more that have closed down. So have I been to, I haven't been to them all for sure, but certainly more than 100, probably more than 200.
How did you boil the book down to just 50?
It was, you know, a lot of different things. I mean, I just thought about the variety that I wanted to present and what I could, who I knew and how I could quickly, because I don't know, I wrote the book in 3 months, which was also an enormous challenge. And so I didn't really have the time and space to sort of, you know, stretch out my tentacles as far as I possibly could and trace. So a lot of it had to do with, but not many of them were already on the website. A lot of people thought, oh, you're just putting your web content into, you know, between a couple of pages, but that was not true at all. And even the ones that I had previously written about, I went back and re-interviewed, I took new photos, I wanted to make sure that everything was fresh.
No doubt a lot of these DIY spaces are fleeting. They don't last very long. Have any closed since you published the book?
Yes, absolutely. And so there's a few spaces in the book that were closed when I started, and that was a big debate with my editor. He did not really want me to put in closed spaces, but I felt like this book is not a travel guide. It's Amazon has got it shelved under travel. I hope that it inspires people to travel, and I tried to include some information about how to get to these spaces if you have the tenacity to do so. But it was not written as a photos or something like that. So I was less concerned with will these spaces, you know, it wasn't as important to me that they definitely be spaces that would be there forever. I feel like as a movement that I am somewhat part of, I really wanted to represent it in what I considered a completist sort of way. And there's like Ruby Laud, they lost their space several years ago, or the Red Lotus Room, she also lost her space a couple of years ago, but they have been so important inspirationally and locationally and ethically, you know, to the things that came after that I thought the book would be really incomplete without including them. So that's one answer. And then, yeah, some of the spaces that I put in because I was pretty sure that they definitely wouldn't close have closed, like Galapagos, which pulled the rug out from under our feet and moved to Detroit. Galapagos. It was a performance center. They did a lot of burlesque and cabarets and dance performances. They also started in Williamsburg in the late 90s in a mayonnaise factory on North 6th Street. That was the first Brooklyn space that I ever actually went to. Long before I knew anything about any of these things, I went there from college and blew my mind. It was just a kind of performance art, dissonant music, like weird. The bathrooms didn't have walls. They had curtains and people were in various stages of bizarre dress. And it was very revelatory for a, you know, nice Jewish girl from the suburbs. So they were in Williamsburg and then they kind of grew up and they moved to Dumbo. And they had this big, beautiful theater where, yeah, like I said, they put on kind of offbeat, but like much like a higher scale sort of thing, like not exactly the, you know, your image of a performance artist, some sort of like crazy person self-flagellating while playing a harp and, you know, doing a handstand. It was a lot more like higher end entertainment that you might take your parents to if they had like an expansive sense of what was appropriate. But so they've got, I don't know, they own tens of thousands of square feet of space in Detroit now, and they're trying to put in an entire arts complex there. And, you know, they've got the experience from having been in Williamsburg of going into a underserved community and bringing together a real intensity of artists. So I hope that they have the same success in Detroit.
Did you have any concern at all that by exposing any of the underground spaces that you would be harming them, that you could force them to shut down because now they're on the radar?
Yeah, that's absolutely been a concern the whole time I've done this project. I typically introduce myself to people who I, you know, who I'm going to cover who don't know me and don't know my work by saying, I am not a real journalist. This is not the same kind of thing where everything you say is on the record and I'm going to print a photograph of your doorway and put your contact information on the internet. Like, I will not reveal things that I am not given permission to reveal. So I have a long conversation before I turn on any kind of recorder about what is and is not okay to talk about. I never publish addresses. We talked for a minute. Somebody, I think my editor or my designer suggested that we do the table of contents as a map of Brooklyn with page numbers, which would have been so beautiful, but I was not comfortable revealing those things. What I will do is I'll include, if the space has a website or a Facebook page or even a Twitter feed, I'll put that in, because I do want, it's such a fine line. Most of these spaces will live and die based on getting people in the door. But it has to be the people who are respectful and who understand what a precious gift it is to have an underground space and to and who will not carelessly reveal it to the wrong sorts of folks, which would invite excess oversight and et cetera. So I do a lot of work to make sure that people know that I am on their side, I suppose, that I am trustworthy. And also, all of my spaces got final approval of the text, of the photographs, to make sure that I hadn't inadvertently revealed something that they felt would have been detrimental to them.
How frequently does your phone ring, and on the other end is someone saying, Oriana, tell me where to go tonight?
That's a great, yeah, that actually, nobody calls me because I don't really pick up my phone, but texting and email, yeah, a lot. I get, I've got a date and I don't know where to take her. What would you recommend? I mean, Brooklyn Spaces has a public calendar, or a lot of times people will say, yeah, I looked at your calendar and I don't know what any of that stuff is. Can you just tell me which one I'm actually going to like? I write pieces I'm actually working on a piece right now for Brooklyn-based 101 things to take your parents to in Brooklyn, because, you know, yeah, I mean, I have almost by accident amassed a pretty vast store of knowledge of what's going on where. The woman who runs a space called Gemini and Scorpio, she also has been writing an events newsletter for, I think, over a decade. And when I interviewed her, we were discussing the fact of keeping track of events allows you to keep track of spaces. It allows you to keep track of the people. It allows you to keep track of the kind, like the themes in the sort of entertainment that are big right now. And so, yeah, having done that for such a while, I do really have a pretty clear. You can give me a call anytime. You could send me an email anytime, and I will tell you what the most exciting thing is to do on any day coming up.
Oriana, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
That was Oriana Leckert. Her book, Brooklyn Spaces, 50 Hubs of Culture and Creativity, is out now from Monticelli Press. Oriana also blogs at brooklyn-spaces.com. When you think of vodka in New York City, a place like Brighton Beach might come to mind because of its vibrant Russian community. But we found vodka in Sunset Park, Brooklyn, at another space featured in Oriana's book. Industry City Distillery is blending science and art into vodka. Cityscape producer Taylor Nulk paid them a visit to find out more.
Hi, my name is Ronak Parikh. I work here at Industry City Distillery. I'm in charge of sales, distribution, and operations.
I'm Zachary Bruner. I work at Industry City Distillery, and I'm the machinist, fabricator, and distiller.
Where are we right now?
Right now, you're located in Sunset Park, Brooklyn, in Industry City. We are at sixth floor of Building 5 of Industry City. That's what we got our name from, Industry City Distillery. We got the gorgeous view of Manhattan, of New Jersey, Statue of Liberty from our space here.
Who is behind Industry City Distillery?
So it's actually the only guy who's missing is David Carrico, and the other person on the team is not actually a person at all, but is our cat, Scratchy, who is our entire PR and marketing department. She does a pretty good job with it.
It wasn't necessarily a start in chemistry or biology. Where did the team kind of form from?
It was a start in all kinds of things, but mostly in people who've been having fun making stuff. And so distilling actually grew out of making CO2, which grew out of making fish tanks, which is what Dave was doing before this all started. And so he was using yeast to create CO2 to feed these fish tanks and keep basically underwater greenhouses to keep them self-sustaining. And it turned out that alcohol was actually a byproduct. And some experimentation followed, and he realized that actually that byproduct might have the possibility to become a business in its own right. And that's where everybody else came in.
One thing I would add is, it was interesting, I joined the team a little over a year ago, and when I met Dave and Zach, I found that they were not scientists per se, but their backgrounds were heavily rooted in art, but clearly with a focus from science, driven by science, and that leads almost everything you see here, a blending of art and science to create the vodka.
Industry City Distillery is part or an offshoot of something called the City Foundry, which is kind of billed as a research and design group focused on improving small-scale manufacturing processes through that blending of science and art. And Zach, you and Dave were co-founders of the Foundry?
That's right. And the idea was to essentially, I wanted a shop with windows in Brooklyn. He wanted a lab and an unlimited R&D budget. And we're still working on the unlimited part. We're actually still working on having the time to really explore any of it. But the idea was that if you could build systems yourself, you could actually take advantage of innovations that have come along in the past few years in science and use those to make products and processes to make those products.
Industry City is described as being experimental. Can you kind of describe more of what goes into this unique distillation?
The process is fermentation with encapsulated yeast, which means that instead of taking a bunch of corn or grain, throwing it into a big tank, and throwing some yeast in after it, stirring it around, we actually take yeast, grow it in our lab, encapsulate it into balls of alginate, which is the same stuff as you'd use for fake caviar or a spherified dessert, and then pass our wash through that. And we pack a huge amount of yeast in a really tiny space, and we can ferment to 14% alcohol in about 24 hours, 25 gallons at a time. It doesn't sound like a lot when you put it that way, but it's equivalent to about 6 kegs of finished beer every single day, 7 days a week. And then we've got 2 stills, one continuous steam-powered stripping still and one fractional reflux still. Fancy names, but basically the first one just separates alcohol from water about 5 times more efficiently than any other traditional still. And the next one separates out the constituent components and all the flavors created in fermentation, lets us separate those out and then taste those and blend them back into the final vodka.
I think the really key things to note here are the constraints that New York City offers. It's energy is expensive, water's expensive, space is expensive, all of which is addressed by the processes Zach just described.
This unique aspect of Industry City is its focus on efficiency and sustainability. How else has the distillery kind of embraced that concept? You use something, it's a sugar beet. How is that sustainable in regards to being in New York?
The main thing about distilling in general is you've got to ferment something. Usually that's grains, potatoes, starches of some sort. The problem with that is once you're done with them, they've got to go somewhere. And when you're out upstate or in the country, you can find a pig farmer nearby who can take it. There just aren't enough pig farmers within driving distance of New York City for that to make sense as a really scalable system. And so we're using beet sugar. It's just like you'd use for cooking. We're using beets because they're head and shoulders above everything else in terms of sugar yield per acre. And they grow naturally in most of the U.S. There's a big belt from the Great Lakes through the Dakotas. And so we can get a highly energy efficient in terms of yield per acre product that comes to us in granulated processed form. The processing is efficient. The waste streams on that are really well managed. And then we end up with a product that has no solid waste. The only thing that we have to throw away are the bags it comes in.
You used mechanical background to kind of build your systems. How are your systems different than the traditional copper use in distillation process?
Almost entirely. I'm looking over at the still room, which you can't see because we're on the radio, but there's virtually no copper here. All of our stills are insulated, and they use a fraction of the energy and a fraction of the water of normal systems. Our continuous stripping still actually recycles waste heat produced by the system to preheat the incoming wash and saves even more energy that way. So it's a 8.5 kilowatt system that actually only needs 5.5 kilowatts to run because of that internal reuse. The other still is a column still, which is pretty uncommon for distilleries. It's especially uncommon because it's a packed column, so it'll do in about 14 feet of, or 10 feet of column height, what a normal still or what a traditional still would have to be 60 feet tall to do. And so we can actually fit it into a Brooklyn warehouse that doesn't have particularly tall ceilings.
There's this usual conception of a craft product, especially a craft spirit, as kind of handmade but non-mechanized. Industry City is highly technological and influenced by this form of machinery, but you're still a craft product with small team, handmade, hand-tested. How have the changing technologies influenced your process, and how do they continue to influence your process as you grow?
Well, the tricky thing about vodka spirits in general, you can't actually make them by hand. You need machines. And that's something that a lot of people kind of gloss over. And we like machines. You know, coming back to the earlier question, I find that a lot of machinery, especially from the era that I love, which is middle of last century and back, there's a great intersection of machinery and art. People cared about how things worked, how things looked, and how things were to use. And we do that here, too. We care about how our machines work and what it's like to actually use the things we build every day to make the product we want to sell. So we're interested in how that can extend people's capabilities to do great things and make delicious things, rather than trying to say that things are better because they're devoid of machinery. We want to use machines to make them better.
What is the benefit of keeping this human aspect of testing and tasting and making sure it's still, as a consumer, is the best of the best because you have hand-picked what's going into them?
I think that's the key, is the human element is the quality control aspect. It's being able to taste and smell every batch, making sure it's up to our standards, making sure it's consistent with our previous batches. Because at the end of the day, our consumer comes to expect a certain type of flavor and character from our product, and we have to remain consistent to that and true to that.
There's an XKCD cartoon from a while back where it's like, meaningless task. I'll write a script to automate this. Time spent writing script grows and grows and grows, and far, far outweighs the time spent doing the task in the first place. And that's the problem we come up on. We could go full automation, but in order to do it comprehensively and in a way that will ensure quality, it's going to take more time than we can currently spare. So when we grow to a dozen people and have more time and money for it, it would be great to take over some of that. But in the end, Ronak's right. It all comes down to, does it taste good? And for now, at least, and for a long time into the future, that decision is best going to be made by figuring out whether it tastes good, and that's going to be a human choice.
In this process where nothing is safe from change, how is industry standard, which is your current vodka, different from its origin?
It's totally different from its origin in some ways, and very slightly different in others. There have been tweaks at almost every step of the production process. It actually started out in an entirely different bottle. They were the numbered batches, 2, 3, and 4, and then the changes in that reflected changes in the production process.
I'd say to that end, you'll never know what to expect from us in the future. I would like to think the vodka will get better tasting, better flavor, better character as we get better behind the process.
You mentioned the future. From a sales point of view, where do you see Industry City Distillery growing to? It's still relatively small batch. Do you see it growing any larger?
Absolutely. Right now, our main focus is to own the identity that we are New York City's only local vodka, only vodka distillery. We want to own that local landscape, then push regionally to our neighboring states, and then go fully national.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Ronak Parikh and Zachary Bruner of Industry City Distillery talking with their very own Taylor Nulk. You can find more online at drinkicd.com. And that's it for this week's Cityscape. Past episodes of the show are available in our archives at wfuv.org/cityscape. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, like us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter for show updates and New York City tidbits. I'm George Bodarkey. My thanks to producers Taylor Nulk and Claire Drake.
It's WFUV and WFUV HD New York. listener-supported public media from Fordham, the Jesuit University of New York. Music discovery starts here.